So this evening I'll just begin with a quotation from a chant, actually. We often do in Buddhism, actually. Imaya dhamma nu dhamma patipatiya buddham pucemi. Imaya dhamma nu dhamma patipatiya dhammam pucemi. Imaya dhamma nu dhamma patipatiya sangham pucemi. Adha imaya patipatiya jati jara Vyadi maranam ha parimunchi sami. There we are. Didn't hurt at all. So what that means, and it's the theme of the talk tonight, actually is I really honour or pay respects to the Buddha, to the Dhamma and the Sangha by this practice according to Dhamma. Truly by this practice I will be freed from birth, old age, sickness and death. So this is the sense of our practice of Dhamma, our practice of a spiritual discipline, to use that to develop our understanding, our wisdom. And of course the Buddha taught a complete path. And this evening we've done meditation. And sometimes people may think, the meditation, that's it. But it isn't the complete path, it's not the whole path. There's much more to it. And of course, I always say to people too, the path is actually our lives. It's actually what we experience. It's actually our minds, the states of our mind, whether they're wholesome or whether they're negative. And this is something that's actually a 24/7 practice, because we have our minds with us and our bodies with us 24/7, you know, all day and all night. Of course, we're not aware during the night so much. So it's important to, as it were, take on board a complete path, because this is what the Buddha was teaching, was a complete path. And that complete path, of course, is, people know what the complete path is. Anyone? It's a Noble Eightfold Path. So this is the path that takes us to enlightenment. That's the purpose of the Buddha's teaching, actually, is to bring people to enlightenment, to allow them to experience that, create the conditions, the causes for it to happen. And of course the Noble Eightfold Path, just to mention it, is right view, and then it's the right intention or right motivation, and it's right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness or stability of mind. And I know these days, and it's particularly true in Sri Lanka at the moment, everybody is looking for the shortcut. They call it in Sinhala the ketipara. So the shortcut. Everybody wants the shortcut. But I always think of Ajahn Brahm says, the shortcut is the Noble Eightfold Path. We've been going around life after life after life, we don't remember it, for ever so long. So this is the short path that can be done in this very life. Having said that, it reminded me of reading Ajahn Brahm's his story that he wrote in a book called Seeing the Way, which was about the disciples of Ajahn Chah, famous meditation monk, and his experiences of going to Thailand to meditate, to develop this path to enlightenment. And in that, he said he was sure that he could go there to Thailand, ordain, and in 2 years he would crack it. He would be enlightened. And then he was planning, after he became enlightened, what would he do? He'd go back to England, go to Wales, and go and live on a commune. So this was Ajahn Brahm. Now, 40-something years later, I think he's changed his idea, changed his tune, you know. It does take a lot longer. But this is the short path, 40 years, for instance, in terms of many, many lives. There's nothing. And of course, that path, as you can see from Ajahn Brahm's example, is a path of growing, hopefully growing contentment, understanding, wisdom and happiness. So he's not in Wales. He didn't end up in Wales, he ended up in Serpentine, which wasn't on his agenda. So this shortcut is the Noble Eightfold Path, and we need all of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path that I mentioned to you. We don't have one single factor that's enough. Sometimes we may hear that mindfulness is enough, or we may hear that samadhi, this one-pointedness of mind or stillness of mind, is enough. But it's all required. It's all required. And the interesting thing with the Buddha's teaching, as you practice them more and more, you see how they interlock, how it all fits together so well, like a jigsaw puzzle. And it all needs to be there. But of course, you know, the Buddha's teaching, and I hear this very much in Sri Lanka, people are very interested in the theory of the Buddha's teaching. And it's very, you know, intellectually fascinating and satisfying, actually, because it's so deep, so profound, and so interesting, and so consistent. But if we don't practice what the Buddha taught, it's a bit like having a medicine which we don't take, but we put it on a shelf, and we may bow to it occasionally from time to time and think we're going to get the benefit from it. We have to take the medicine. And often the Buddha talked about the Dhamma being the medicine, the Buddha being the doctor. So this is important, that we actually take the medicine, we actually practice what we understand, the theory of the Buddha's teaching. And so now I thought I'd mention, I'm always well known for telling Nasruddin stories. And Nasruddin, some people know who Nasruddin was? He's supposed to be a historical character. It's really 70s or 80s, 1970s or 1980s, I think, Nasruddin. So I'm bringing him back into vogue, perhaps. But Nasruddin was a Sufi, so he was quite a mystical teacher, and somewhat like a Zen character, really, in Sufism. And one day, he was obviously out in the backyard, or behind his house, and he and his wife was making a meal. And he had this big piece of liver, he wasn't a vegetarian, that they were going to cook that for the meal. His wife was probably going to cook it, I think. And down swept an eagle, a bird flew down, this huge bird flew down, grabbed the liver, and then flew off with the liver. Wow. And what did Nasruddin say? He said, "You fool, I still have the recipe." So what is the recipe? What does the recipe stand for? The Buddha's teaching. The liver stands for the practice, the real, the meat of the Dhamma, we'd say. It's the practice. So you can always remember Nasruddin with the liver and the recipe. And sometimes in Buddhist countries, we talk about Amissa Puja, when we make offerings to the Buddha of candles, incense and flowers. But they also talk about Patipata Puja or Dhamma Puja, which is offering our practice. This is the real offering for the Buddha. And he said, when he was about to pass away, the Buddha said, "Ananda," this was his chief, his personal assistant, you might say, personal assistant, who looked after him for 25 years. He said, "Whatever monk, nun, male or female lay follower dwells practicing the Dhamma properly and perfectly fulfills the Dhamma way, he or she honors the Buddha, reveres and esteems him, and pays him the supreme homage." And he says, "Therefore, Ananda, we will dwell practicing the Dhamma properly and perfectly fulfill the Dhamma way. This must be your watchword." Interesting wording, your watchword. So what do you think practicing the Dhamma properly and perfectly fulfill the Dhamma way is? I would say it's becoming enlightened. So that's how we really fulfill it. But it's with any teacher, isn't it? Any teacher of any subject is very happy if the students actually put into practice what they teach and actually get some results, get some benefits. And this is what the Buddha is pointing to when he spoke those words, just before he was about to pass away, we say, into parinibbana. And even despite the fact that I've said, candles, incense and flowers are not, this is not the practice, this is not offering our practice to the Buddha, ceremonies and these sorts of things do have their place. They're very popular in Sri Lanka. We have some huge ceremonies now happening. When I say huge, I mean you have 2 million people, 4 million people. Well, it's incredible at some of these very big stupas or chaityas, they're called. And they can look very beautiful, actually. People do ask me about them. But these ceremonies and rituals, they have their place in Buddhism because they can bring people together. And in order to put on some ceremony like this, you need a lot of working together and harmony. And recently, at the monastery, did people go to the katina? We call it the katina, or the robe offering ceremony. There was one at the monastery about 2 weeks ago. And these occasions can be very useful for our practice because they can bring up faith. They can bring up a faith, a sort of joy. Faith is an emotion of joy, of seeing value in things, seeing worth in things. And that, the Buddha said, can lead to energy. So we can start to apply ourselves. This is the five indriyas, actually. And when we apply ourselves, then we can use mindfulness to remember where we need to apply ourselves, to the present moment, to remembering the teachings of the Buddha, these things. And then from that, we can develop this samadhi, this one-pointedness. The mind can go really deep, really penetrate. And when it really penetrates, then we can develop wisdom. So these ceremonies can be useful if used like that. Most often, people just enjoy the feeling that comes up with faith. And that's, I always say, that's not so bad. You know, that's not, they may not take it and apply it to their practice, but this is not so bad because it's a wholesome emotion, a positive emotion. So it is something that is worthwhile. So what is the practice? One of the most important things for practice, and I think it's the thermometer I use, and I think most practicing Buddhists would use, is that we're growing in wholesome states of the mind, positive states of mind, and the negative states of mind, the unwholesome states of mind, are going down, reducing. And of course, you know, the whole point of the Buddha's path, enlightenment, is to let go of the negative states of mind. Totally. They've gone for good. They're not there. They will not return. And to develop those positive states of mind. And this is the essence of the Buddha's teaching. In fact, there's another quotation that many Buddhists will know here, actually. It is, Sammabhavassa akaranam kusalasa upasampada Sajita pariyoda panang etang buddhana sasanang. And that translates as not to do any bad, to cultivate the good, and to purify one's mind. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas. So when we're purifying the mind, meditation is part of that purification of the mind. And as I say, to develop, not to do the bad, to cultivate the good. This is the essence of the Buddha's teaching. So, the overview of the path that I think is very useful, and I'll talk about a little bit more, is the giving. There are three aspects to it: giving or dana, ethical behavior, this is sila, and mental cultivation, sometimes called bhavana. And these are ways we can look at our practice. They're all very, very important and vital for our practice, actually. And so I'll focus on these. But seeing as we started with the meditation, and Ajahn Chah, famous Thai meditation master, he noted that in the West, people often start from, what do they start from in terms of the path? Meditation, usually. we do it in reverse. Usually the traditional way is first giving, dana, then sila, and then bhavana, which includes meditation, not only meditation. But in the West, we tend to do it in the opposite way. We try out the meditation, we find some value in it for making the mind peaceful, more clear, more wise, more joyful states of mind. And then we start, having got that sort of confidence, we may start to keep the seal and keep ethical behaviour, and then from that may develop the confidence, the faith, to start giving, not only to the Sangha, to seeing giving as an important part of the path. So I liken mental development is really cultivating the mind. And it's an idea that actually is not very common. Most of us, we don't have this sense of cultivating the mind. We just let things come in and the mind just sort of be, as it were. And so there's a lot of influences that we take on board from the internet, from television, from our friends, from family, from all sorts of places that we don't look at, and we don't question whether they're useful, whether they're actually benefiting us or not. So I liken this mental cultivation, mental development, to looking for the treasure, because the mind, and the mind, the heart, that is the treasure, that is the place. And there's another nice Nasruddin story that brings this home. One evening, Nasruddin was outside his house. This is one of my favourite stories, I tell it often. So he's outside his house, under the street lamp, street light. And he was looking on the ground very intently, here, there and everywhere. And his neighbour came out and he saw Nasruddin looking, searching for something. And he asked him, "What are you looking for, Nasruddin? What have you lost?" And he said, "The key to my house." And the man said, "Well, I'll give you a hand. We can find it in no time, flat." So he looked for it. And of course they looked everywhere and they couldn't find it. And so the neighbour said to Nasruddin, as people often do, "Do you know where you lost it? Do you know where you lost the key?" And Nasruddin said, "Yes, yes, I know where I lost the key." And he said, "Where did you lose the key?" He said, "Inside the house." And the neighbour said, "Why are we looking outside?" He said, "Ah, the light's much better here." We're like that too. We're outside the house looking for happiness. We're outside the house looking for fulfillment, because that's our five senses taking us out. But where is the happiness coming from? Where is the treasure? It's inside. We all know that, actually, people know that. But I think Nasruddin's story, looking for the key is happiness. It's that treasure inside each of us. And to look inside is actually reversing the way we look at the... We usually look out to the world. We're looking for happiness from what we see, hear, smell, taste and touch, whether it be videos, whether it be music, conversations, whether it be food, that's very popular, physical touches, massage, sex, all these things. Yes, and also smells, perfumes, flowers, all the works. So we're looking for the world to give us the happiness, but the happiness really comes, we know, most people know this really, we just know it from inside. And I liken the mind to the control panel. It's the master control. This is where we can really develop and cultivate the mind. And as the Buddha often said, the mind is the forerunner. And we know that. People can experience this. It's very easy to see that the mind states that we develop, we cultivate, whether knowingly or unknowingly, are the ways we experience the world. So somebody can be experiencing, we can be, I think we're here, however many people are here, we're probably experiencing this in so many different ways, depending on our conditioning, where we're coming from. We can, you know, some people maybe think, "When's he going to finish?" "Well, I didn't come here for this," or "It's too hot," or whatever may be going on. You know, our mind states can be very, very varied. Of course, you know, coming to a Buddhist centre like this, coming for meditation, we're tending to be more in a similar vein. But our mind states can be so different, and they determine the reality that we experience. There is a real world out there. The Buddha never said that the world was mind-made. But the world we experience, there is a physical world out there. There is a world of the four elements, we say. But the way we experience it, that's our business. And it's up to us. We can cultivate different states of mind and have different outcomes. As I say, the positive states of mind. And one of my favorite ways of looking at the mind, apart from being a treasure, was Ayakema, one of my teachers, famous Buddhist nun. She would talk about the mind being a jewel of a mind. The mind, of course, can cause a lot of problems too, actually, for us. But in essence, it is actually a jewel. And in meditation, part of the practice of meditation is to clean off the dirt from this jewel of a mind. And the dirt is, of course, you know, our greed, hatred and delusion. These are the three primary roots, we say, of the negative. You know, this includes all things like anger, envy, jealousy. You can name it. Stinginess, meanness, lots of things. So part of the practice of meditation is to clean the mind, as does giving clean the mind too. Because when we give, we're reducing that sense of what I want, what I need, and thinking of somebody else. So it's a very good way of reducing our greed, our sense of self-centeredness, that we are the center of the universe. And also, when we practice ethical conduct, that's cleaning the mind too. Because in order to keep, say, the five precepts, not killing living beings, not stealing, not indulging in sexual misconduct, not lying and not taking alcohol and drugs, in doing that, we are cleaning the mind, because the mind has to be able to say no sometimes. This is actually a great strength. It's not a common thing in the West to think of saying no is a great strength, but being able to say no to negative mind states and actions and speech that are just going to cause us grief, cause us unhappiness, to be able to say no to them is a great boon for us. It's something that's worth developing. And the Buddha had a nice description of the jewel-like quality of the mind. He said, luminous, monks, is this mind when it is freed from defilements. These are the negative aspects of the mind that visit it. The instructed noble disciple understands this as it really is. Therefore, I say that for the instructed noble disciple, there is development of the mind. So that's quite a nice, the idea of the luminous mind, that the essential quality of the mind is pure. It's just overlaid with some of the rubbish we've accumulated for many, many lifetimes from our conditioning. And I liken this to, it's an experience that I like very much, when you travel, when you fly, and it's a very cloudy day, as it was in Melbourne when I left. And it's very cloudy and grey, maybe, and cold. And then the plane goes through the clouds and there's blue sky everywhere. And this reminds me of what the Buddha is talking about, that luminous mind, that pure quality of mind which we can develop. And very much, we don't look after our minds. We tend to ignore them. We look after the body. We do a lot for the body. In fact, most of our lives are geared for the body. Our houses are geared for it. We've got chairs, we've got toilets, we've got dining rooms, beds. We've got everything for the body. But where do we have a home for the mind? And this is where the meditation, this returning to looking inward, is so important, because this is the home for the mind. The mind is, we pay little attention to it. We're more interested in the things outside, our family, our friends, our possessions, wealth, status, power, position and reputation. Those are worldly things. And the interesting thing with all those things, can't take them with us. We can't take them with us when we die. But if we look after the mind, if we do a bit of interior decoration with the mind, we can take that with us. The mind will travel on to the next life. Very interestingly, Ajahn Brahm calls the monastery Ajahn Brahm's beauty parlour. I don't know that we're looking very good on the outside, but the idea is that the mind will be very beautiful. That radiant mind, that pure mind, is something that we can all develop. And the way we can develop this, of course, is through the bhavana, this cultivation of the mind, is through right effort. The right effort is just for us to avoid or let go of negative or unwholesome states of mind. This is not always easy, actually. We can buy into negative states of mind, especially anger we can get attached to. We may even feel very right. So this is avoiding and letting go of those negative states of mind, because we know they're rubbish. We know that they don't bring us happiness. And I often liken this to taking the wheelie bins out. Every week, people take their wheelie bins of rubbish out onto the verge and leave it there for the council to take away. But how often do we take the mental wheelie bin out to the verge with all the rubbish that's in there and put it on the verge, let it go? This is much more important. And if we don't, if we don't let go of the rubbish in the wheelie bin, if we keep that, it gets really smelly and unhygienic. What to say of our minds when we've got all these resentments, anger, guilt, all those sorts of negative emotions. So avoiding and letting go of those, recognizing them as for what they are, actually, is very important. Sometimes we find it difficult to recognize these negative states of mind, anger, jealousy, greed, stinginess, whatever it be, depression, anxiety. We have a difficulty recognizing them as rubbish. But rubbish is anything that doesn't bring happiness to us, that's bringing a lot of unhappiness to us. It's heavy, it's dark, and it doesn't feel good. The only reason we hang on to rubbish, because it's our rubbish. That's the big deal. Because we think it's our rubbish, but actually we've just accumulated it over time. And it's not our rubbish, really. It's just come from causes and conditions in the past, and we can let it go. Once we realize, no, it's not our rubbish, we don't have to keep it, we don't have to identify with it, attach with it. So very, very important. So this right effort is actually the essence of purifying the mind. So that's avoiding and letting go of the negative states of mind. But the other half, you notice with the Buddha's teaching, always beautiful balance, symmetry with it. Usually the negative first, then the positive. And the positive is developing and maintaining positive states of mind. Those states of mind that lift us, give us inspiration, give us happiness, give us joy, give us a sense of meaning and purpose in our life. These sorts of states of mind are well worth developing, well worth maintaining. And we can develop and cultivate these things. We don't have to just allow our minds to be these sort of repositories of stuff that comes into us, just mulls around. We can choose what we develop in the mind. And the other aspect of this mental cultivation, of course, in terms of the Noble Eightfold Path, is right mindfulness, being mindful, remembering what we remembering the teachings and remembering what we're being mindful of. So for instance, when we were doing the scanning meditation, we were mindful of the sensations in the body or the feelings, that whether they be pleasant, unpleasant or neutral. And a good example too is, using the idea of sati, the original meaning being remembering. And Ajahn Tanisara, he uses keeping the breath in mind. When we do the breath meditation, keeping it in mind, that's mindfulness. Often we think of mindfulness too as just as being in the present, and that's an important part of it. And the other way we purify the mind, we cultivate the mind is through the meditation we were doing, by bringing the mind together, allowing the mind to come to oneness, to stillness, to steadiness. What that does, of course, is reduce the negative qualities of the mind. And Ayakema, one of my teachers, used to say, one moment of, she'd say, concentration. Ajahn Brahm said, no. One moment of concentration is one moment of purification. Because when the mind comes together, when the mind has wholesome, positive states, experiencing positive, wholesome states, there is no room for the negative. It drops, it reduces. And so little by little, we are learning the way to purify the mind, to reduce these negative aspects of the mind, and increase the positive. As we, the good news, when we reduce the negative, these dark, these heavy, smelly, unhygienic emotions, states of mind, happiness comes up. When we remove the negative, happiness, joy comes up. And as I mentioned, you know, the way we can do this, of course, is giving abandons greed and thinking of others, not just number one. And sila, the ethical behavior, that helps us too, because we're reducing the unwholesome actions and speech. And to do that, we have to use our mind. So we are actually cultivating, purifying the mind at the same time. And a very important part of mental cultivation is developing what we call right intention or right attitude, I like. And this is the attitude of not of giving up, not trying to get and gain. This is our main preoccupation, actually, getting and gaining. And the idea, the whole of the Buddha's teaching is about giving up, giving things away, letting go. It's another word for it, letting go. Also developing these positive emotions of loving kindness, compassion, and non-harming, not hurting ourselves or others. This is a very important part of mental cultivation, bhavana. And as I mentioned, classically, when we talk about developing this, the Buddha talks about, it's lovely actually, it should encourage us about when we develop the meditation, part of the process is, first of all, we call it the mindfulness. We're aware, and then we're aware of the qualities of the mind, the state of the mind. This is called investigation of the state of the mind, dhammas, dhammavicaya. And then after that, virya can come up. This is energy. We can get energy. Once there is the negative states of mind go down, we tend to get energy. And then we can develop gladness and this sort of joy of, it's like a joy, and then a deeper joy, like a rapture, and then tranquility when the body and the mind become very peaceful. And you can see this in the meditation, you know, when the body and the mind become very peaceful. And sometimes people feel as if they're not aware of their body, you know, or parts of their body, and happiness as well. Happiness comes up, and the Buddha said, happiness, not suffering, happiness is a necessary condition for the mind to come together, for the one-pointedness of mind, for the stillness and steadiness. So sometimes people say Buddhism is so pessimistic, but really, the emphasis is really on happiness. We need that to develop these very powerful, deep, peaceful, still states of mind, where we can actually see things very, very clearly, very, very differently, you know, from our ordinary perceptions of reality. So I was just going to mention too a little bit about the scanning meditation as we're doing bhavana, still on bhavana, and just to mention that this scanning meditation is very good for the health. Ayakema was recommending it for health, so that if we have any illnesses or whatever, that mindfulness of the body, just going through the body, can be very healing. And there is a book that's not coming from about scanning called Dhamma Therapy by Mahasi Sayadaw. And that's using mindfulness, just that awareness, attention to the body, the power of it, to overcome illnesses. I read that book, and some of the people were going through extraordinary pains, and they used their mindfulness and faith, actually, to stay with it and go through it. And then they often were completely relieved of that illness. Not easy. But when we use this scanning meditation for healing, it's important for healing that we don't have a negative state of mind towards whatever illness, be it a cancer or whatever illness we have, heart problems, lung problems, you name it. It's best if we have a more positive attitude, like loving kindness, like we did when we were relaxing the body. This is quite useful, because any negativity is only adding to the situation, only making it worse. And when we pay attention to the body, it's very much like if you meet somebody and they are looking at their smartphone or reading the newspaper or looking over the shoulder and ignoring you, how do you feel? Most people don't like that. But if you give attention to somebody, if you look at them, if you're with them, Ajahn Brahm's very good at this, people like this. And this is very useful for the body too. When we pay attention to the body, we use the body, but we don't give it much attention. Yes, we want it to look this way and that way, for sure, but we're not actually giving much attention to the body. So when we were doing the scanning, I don't know if you noticed, but I certainly have noticed when I first started scanning, how many sensations there were that I never, never noticed before. It was really an eye-opener for me. And of course, this scanning technique can also lead to very deep states of peace. It's often thought of as vipassana, and it can lead in that direction too, but it's can lead to peace as well and to jhana-like experiences. And it's very, one of the things that is quite interesting with this scanning meditation is that because the mind affects the body and the body affects the mind, when we scan, you might notice, I've noticed with myself, that you can come across, what do you come across besides these sensations? Emotions, like fear, anger, then different parts of the body. There can be anxiety, depression. We can experience it in the body. And this scanning can help, as it were, relieve or release some of these stored up emotions in the body. It's interesting because, in actual fact, our minds are really sculpting the body we have, which is an interesting thing to realize, that the mind is affecting the body so much. So I think now I didn't get on to giving. Maybe I'll just mention very briefly the other two parts of the three that I mentioned. You might remember giving, ethical behavior, and also mental cultivation. We've only done mental cultivation. But giving, you could say, summarize it by this saying, which I like very much. It's not from the Buddha. It's give and you shall receive. I think most people recognize that one. Give and you shall receive. And it's true when we give. And giving is actually, it's not, in Buddhism often people think of it as giving to monks and nuns, to the Sangha. But our giving is, it can be 24/7 to anybody, to everybody, to ourselves, to our family, to our children, material things, emotional support, many, many things we can give. So we think too narrowly of giving. Giving is really the whole of our lives in one way or another. And it's something, when we think of the various things we do as giving, when a parent thinks of looking after their children, admittedly you have to do it day in, day out, as giving, it changes the way we relate to it. It brings in a different energy to it, a significance, an importance to it. And this is something that we can do. And as I said, it's not only material things, it can be attention, kindness, a smile can be a real gift to others. And humour, Ajahn Brahm's humour is, some may think of it as a gift, some might like to return it to the sender, I don't know. Return to sender. And advice, very useful. So these are all forms of giving. And of course, helping out here at the Buddhist Centre is a great form of giving, because it's a great, it can help many, many people, develop happiness in their lives. And the other side I was going to, the last thing I was going to mention is ethical behaviour. And this is the essence of heart of the path in many ways for me. If we don't have ethical behaviour, then meditation is very difficult. It's very difficult. Developing wisdom is very difficult as well. The base, the foundation, is the ethical behaviour. And ethical behaviour brings, if we break any of the five precepts, for instance, you can be sure, we can be absolutely sure, it will bring problems, difficulties, and unhappiness into our lives. This is a recipe, you know, when we keep the five precepts, it can add to our happiness, it can reduce the problems and difficulties in our lives. And the essence of ethical behaviour is that we're not harming ourselves or others. So this is the essence of ethical behaviour. And as I said, training the mind to say no is a great ability, is a great strength. To say no to negative things, to things that drag the mind down, is very useful. And I like Bhante Gunaratana. He had a lovely saying which really puts it in a nutshell. And he says, simply refuse to let your anger tell you what to say. Simply refuse to let your anger tell you what to say. And also when we follow ethical behaviour, we've got more choice. We choose how we're going to react. We don't react automatically. It gives us choice. We take responsibility for our lives. And most importantly, it reminds us too that, and this brings us back to mental cultivation, that external things are only triggers for what's going on inside us. Sure, somebody can say something very hurtful, very negative, but when we get angry, when we give them as good as they gave us, it's coming from in here, it's coming from inside. And this is where the problem is, inside. There'll be many triggers, this is what Iyakhima called them, outsiders. But if we spend our lives blaming the external things, we will not be seeing, we will not be developing the spiritual life, which is the inner life, our reaction to things. And this is really a beautiful simile for this was Ajahn Chah. He gave this very nice simile of the hole. And he said there'd be a hole in the ground and somebody would put their arm in and they'd say, oh, the hole's too deep, the hole's too deep. But he said, they never think, my arm's too short. That's coming back to ourselves. The hole's too deep. But really? My arm's too short. So this is the essence of not blaming others, not blaming the external. So I'd like to finish there because we're a little bit over time, just to emphasize the complete path, practicing a complete path. And this is the shortcut to enlightenment, to happiness. And this is through mental cultivation, and as I mentioned, it's through giving or dana, and it's through keeping ethical conduct. We call the five precepts, usually the basis of ethical conduct, the five precepts. So I'd like to finish there, and if anyone has any questions, comments or complaints, you're welcome to. The complaints are always interesting, actually. I've only ever had one, that was memorable, but... So please, if you have any questions or there are any questions online, yes, please do. Comments? You've got the microphone.
Hello, yeah, Arjun, you mentioned faith, but isn't faith the belief in the absence of facts? And, you know, that's not what Buddhism's about.
Yeah, good point. Is faith the absence of fact, you know? That's one sort of definition, isn't it? In English, we'd say that was the case. But it's really, in Buddhism, faith is always balanced by wisdom, for sure. But it's the sense of, it's the emotion that comes with the feeling that, yes, this has the potential to take me somewhere useful. This has the potential for development of my, developing happiness, developing wisdom. So it's that sort of energy, that sort of inspiration almost, that can give us, like we have faith in so many things. If we don't have faith in something, we won't try it. If we don't have confidence, we have faith in many, many things. You know, science is a, people have a lot of faith in science. Sometimes we balance that with, we see the downside as well. But it's a vital ingredient in the whole of our life. We have to think something's worthwhile, valuable. Faith has that quality that it makes us see something as valuable and worthwhile, potential for our own development and growth. And this is what, you know, when people classically hear the Buddha's teaching for the first time, they may get the sense of, oh, yes, this has got something, you know, there's something there. There's something there that is helpful for me, can take me somewhere that I want to go. And this is faith coming up, a recognition that there is value there, there's something worthwhile that we can use for our own development and then try it out for ourselves. So it's really just that initial energy that gives us, that initial input that gives us the energy to actually try something, whether it be the Buddha's path or whatever we have faith in. But it's a vital ingredient. If we don't have faith in ourselves, for instance, that's very difficult too. We've got to have some sort of confidence and faith in ourselves, our abilities, our character, our qualities. So it's a vital ingredient, actually. As I mentioned, it leads on to energy, leads on to mindfulness, leads on to one-pointedness of mind, leads on to wisdom as a sequence. So thank you for that. That was good, yes. But faith is a loaded word too in English, you know, because we always, you know, we bring a lot to that word. It's, yeah. Yes. Ah, there, the iPad. Two iPads. Right. So this is from Francesca in England. Life can be very challenging for sure. I try to be mindful. What do you do if a family member constantly drains your energy? What do you do if a family member constantly drains your energy? Well, I think in that case, one just has to, you know, ask yourself, you know, yes. I think first of all, you know, you have to look at your own mind and see what is benefiting, what can lift the mind, what can give you energy rather than have it drained by your family members. When I read drains the family member, drains your energy, it sounds like there really needs to be work with the relationship, doesn't it? You know, to work on that. I don't know, Francesca, if that is meaningful for you. Sometimes we need to, of course, if we change our minds, if we bring peace and joy, happiness to our minds, it can change others around us. But sometimes we have to also deal with situation dynamics in families, in our relationships, and sort them out, work out with the other person too, what we can, what's best for us. And of course, there's always the option to move away if that's possible. That can be, if it's not resolvable, to move away can be a positive thing to do. So, but I think one of the things I always encourage for all of us, myself included, when we have difficult questions, is just to get peaceful, get still, and then, have that in mind, what the question is, what the problem is, but let it go, get peaceful, get still, and then see what comes to the mind. Because sometimes you can get, I get intuitions, you know, solutions that I hadn't thought of, they come from left field. And without knowing your family dynamics in some detail, I would suggest that, just to see. You know, it might be something very unorthodox or different from what you thought, but it could work. So I hope that somewhat addresses it, Francesca. And there's Michael in Indonesia. How do I know and learn the pure and real Dhamma? How do I know and learn the pure and real Dhamma? Yes. Well, the pure and real Dhamma is leading towards positive states of mind, and reducing the negative states of mind, that's for sure. It's leading towards enlightenment, it's leading to insight, it's leading to peace, it's leading to all these things. That, you know, I know Ayakema often said, you know, the method that works for you is the right one. So if it's right, if it's working for you, it's going in this direction, going in the direction of the Dhamma, going towards enlightenment, peace, happiness, reducing the negative. In essence, that's the pure and real Dhamma. So Michael, I hope that that answers that. If it's going in the right direction, it's the pure and real Dhamma. If the mind is becoming more pure, wonderful. And Karina in the UK, can you please explain samadhi in depth? How to practice? How to practice it? I think how to practice it? How to do? Well, that's a very long question. A very long answer, anyway. But there's I think just as we were practicing this evening, you know, developing the meditation, this is how we develop samadhi. We bring the mind, in essence, we bring the mind, focus it on what, try to bring it to oneness, using one object, often one object, bring it to oneness. And that way, developing the samadhi, very important. One thing that I teach is that to encourage the mind to come to oneness, use a positive, wholesome state, mental state, like metta, loving kindness. Giving a gift is like giving a gift of kindness, is metta, of loving kindness. These positive emotions, bring it to the object. You can use it with the object, with the breath, breathing in metta, breathing out metta, loving kindness. And when we do that, then the mind becomes far, far more interested in the object. And breath itself is fairly neutral. It's not exciting. It's not something you write home about. But if you put some loving kindness with it, if you give it a positive emotion, it can be gratitude, it can be contentment, it can be a compassion, any positive emotion, that will make it that more attractive. So that's how, you know, I develop it. But of course, you know, the practice of samadhi in depth is the four jhanas. It's developing the four jhanas. These are very deep meditations. And I recommend Ajahn Brahm's book on the jhanas. He's got a little thin free distribution book. Probably can download it somewhere on the jhanas. And that's developing it in depth. Because Samma Samadhi is the four jhanas, these very, very deep states of mind that take us to another world of experience and give us such a different view of the world of the five senses that we live in, we all live in. We think this is happiness, but after those experiences that the jhanas offer, then we have something to compare and we can see, we'll see things very, very differently and we'll develop a lot of wisdom in the process. So thank you very much, Karina. I think that's not very much of a detailed explanation, but I recommend that book, Ajahn Brahm's book on the jhanas. There we are. So thank you very much. Now we can finish by paying respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, if you would like.
Sūpatipanno
bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho saṅghaṁ namāmi.